What I wanted to do today was take you through some of the changes of approach that the Rudd Labor government is taking to healthcare, some of the issues that are our priority reform areas. I particularly want to talk to you about rural health. We're releasing our rural health audit today. And there were so many issues that we are working actively in that I imagine that there'll be many I won't touch in the speech, touch on in the speech that some of you are interested in. I'm told we have 15 or 20 minutes for questions afterwards. So, of course, if there's anything I haven't touched upon that you're passionately interested about, please feel free to ask me. There is a lot happening, as Rowan has indicated, in health policy at the moment, and it's a very exciting area to be in. We do feel like we're having a serious and fresh go at Commonwealth-state relations. We have just announced over the weekend what will turn into the biggest Commonwealth investment in prevention ever seen in this country. And today we are taking a step along a new path to delivering health workforce issues and reforms in the rural health sector so that families living in rural Australia can get the healthcare that they need. I'm sure it won't be as a surprise to any of you that we've had a very busy couple of months in our first few months of being in government. To develop the ambitious goals that we've set ourselves, we are trying to take a dual-track approach to health reform, delivering immediate benefits in the here and now, as well as laying out a comprehensive structure to deliver the reforms that we know are so needed to build the modern Australia and the modern health system that we need for a modern Australia well into the future. It does feel like a tough workload, but I can assure you it is one that I'm finding very satisfying. I feel like we're in a point in time where we can really make a significant difference. A lot of the stars have aligned, and I think not just between the states and the Commonwealth, but between the public and private sector, a range of different interests where people have said we have to do this differently or our health system will not be able to survive. So I want to talk to you today about these challenges and where I see our policies heading, and a little bit about the results of the rural health audit that we've just released today. If we look at the health system the way it stands, we know, and I think we shouldn't forget this, that Australians do enjoy health outcomes that are amongst the best in the world, and we do have access to high quality care. But we also, I think, all know that Australia's health system, which is built around a complex patchwork of funding and service delivery arrangements, is facing serious challenges from the ageing of the population, the rapidly increasing burden of chronic disease, rising costs, and inefficiencies that are exacerbated by cost shifting and the blame game. There's another fact too, which is often overlooked, that it's essential to grasp in order for us to understand the context in which health policy operates. And that is that health policy is inextricably entwined with economic policy. Health policy is going to increasingly influence not just the well-being of individuals, but the ability to tap into Australia's economic potential. Human capital is going to drive our future. So put simply, something that isn't said often enough, good health policy is good economic policy. If we want a strong economy, we have to have a strong health system. And this is just one of the many long-term challenges and economic challenges that was brazenly ignored by the previous government. We know that to deliver on this goal, it requires us to get the balance right in the way that we support and deliver services. We need to keep rising expenditure under control at the same time as we need to be prepared to invest where the human and economic benefits are clear. It's true that a key challenge facing the health system is the rate of growth of health expenditure. Excuse me. On a three-decade projection to 2033, the fastest escalation in costs in health expenditure will be for diabetes at 400%, followed by neurological disorders at 280%. Cardiovascular disease is going to continue to dominate health costs, but it will have slowed its growth to a comparatively modest 105%. But the costs, of course, of these diseases are huge, and they're not just limited to the health sector. We know from the work that Access Economics has done that estimates of the total financial cost to the economy come in at some staggering rates. For cardiovascular disease, it's over $14 billion per year. For obesity, just under $4 billion a year, but that's on the rise. And diabetes also on the rise, just over $10 billion a year. So these are pretty frightening figures, I think not just for health ministers, but for all who are participating in our economy to see the costs of not getting our healthcare and health service delivery right. These figures demonstrate a compelling truth that the government can't afford to treat these policy issues just in separate silos. We don't believe that there's any such thing as a choice between economic investment and investment in health, or for that matter, education or climate change. It's in fact investment in these areas that is going to make possible our long-term prosperity and well into the future. As a nation, the most important long-term economic investment we can make, as I've said, is in human capital, the health, education and skills development of Australians. Dr. Ken Henry, the Treasury Secretary, is fond of noting that Australia's future growth and prosperity rest on our growth in population, participation and productivity, the three Ps, and all very important when you think about health policy. The necessity of long-term investment in the workforce, of course, applies equally as well to the health workforce, both in its own right as a major service industry and employer, but also because the benefits of a good health system deliver to the entire community. Now, we are facing a number of major challenges that are going to impact on our ability to provide a well-qualified and sustainable health workforce into the future. I've already noted our ageing population. By 2047, Australia's total population is projected to be 38% larger than it currently is, with the proportion of over 65s doubling to 25% of the population and over 85s to nearly 6% of the population. So I'm sure those of you in the health insurance industry like Rowan and others are acutely aware of the challenges that these figures present, as they do to us as government. We're also facing, as I've noted, an epidemic of chronic disease, and that's an issue that I want to come back to a bit later. The current health workforce shortages and unprecedented demand for health services highlight the needs for us to achieve much greater efficiency, effectiveness and responsiveness of the health workforce. These anticipated changes must affect the models of service delivery, the numbers and types of healthcare workers that are required, and the development of multidisciplinary approaches to healthcare. Put simply, there is a need to fundamentally rethink the way we utilise our health workforce. And at the recent 2020 summit, a major theme was in fact the need for comprehensive, far-reaching reform in the workforce area. In 2005, the Productivity Commission had already suggested that initiatives were needed that increased the level of education and training, improved retention and re-entry, and examined the productivity of available health workers. Again, the Howard government ignored this report, refusing to even consider how to respond to these emerging challenges, rendering the previous government unable to lead the professions towards some necessary reform. If we similarly fail to address these workforce challenges facing us in health, then we believe it will be impossible to tackle the many other health challenges that confront us. Only a few months into the government, we've already taken many of our first important steps to improving the health system. At the March COAG meeting, we signed the Intergovernmental Agreement on Health Workforce. This agreement will, for the first time, create a single national registration and accreditation system for 9 health professions: medical practitioners, nurses and midwives, pharmacists, physiotherapists, psychologists, osteopaths, chiropractors, optometrists and dentists. Now, I know we're in a mixed audience here, so those of you who don't spend your lives in the health sector might be surprised to know that it was so difficult to get an agreement to, in fact, to say we need national professions in all these areas. Those of you from the health sector will understand that this has been a very tortured process and is only, in fact, the first step along the way of some much-needed reform. Of course, this new arrangement is going to help health professionals move around the country more easily, reduce red tape, provide greater safeguards for the public, and promote a more flexible, responsive and sustainable health workforce. And importantly, this recent agreement is going to, for the first time, enable us to be able to provide comprehensive national health workforce data through a national minimum data set for the professions that it covers. Future workforce initiatives will be able to be based upon that current evidence. We must remember that the key objective of any health workforce reform should be to increase community access to high quality, efficient, effective and financially sustainable health services. We need to force ourselves and the system to focus on the patient, not on the system or on the health professional, in order to determine what is needed for the future. Let me tell you a funny aside that when I first became the Shadow Minister for Health, I think it took about 3 months of meetings before I met the first person who talked to me about improving health outcomes for the community or a patient. Every single meeting I had in those first 3 months was otherwise about the system. what we needed to do to fix the system. Now, I agree there are a lot of systems problems, but we need to remember why we want to reform it, and the purpose has to be to benefit the community and to get better health outcomes. Safety and clinically appropriate care must always be top order, but I must say that simply fighting to maintain professional turf, irrespective of outcomes, should not be. So whilst we want to respond to the need for these sustainable long-term solutions, we also know it's important to address the here and now. So in addressing some of these health workforce challenges, the Rudd Labor government has already taken a number of important steps, in addition to signing on to the registration and accreditation agreement. We've recently announced that we will be supporting up to 50,000 additionally funded health-focused vocational education and training places over the next 3 years. Skills Australia is going to advise COAG, with input, I am sure, from the education sector as well as the states and territories, of the areas that should be focused upon, and that will be provided to the July COAG meeting. We've already outlined a nearly $20 million package to strengthen the capacity of the Indigenous health workforce. We've taken steps towards fulfilling our commitment to deliver 10,000 extra nurses into Australia's health and aged care system. And we have announced and are about to announce the person in the coming weeks who will fulfil a new position of the Commonwealth Chief Nurse and Midwifery Officer within the Department of Health and Ageing to provide advice to government and to build and strengthen the nursing leadership that is needed nationally and provide a national perspective and strategic approach on nursing workforce planning, strategy and education across jurisdictions. And we've just completed an audit of the health workforce in rural and regional Australia. I can't believe that I am announcing this today with a single copy. So this is the only copy in this room. Any of you who want to read it will have to go to your website afterwards, as we only have one that has been sent from Canberra. And I want to talk you through a little bit of the findings that are in this, because I think they're indicative of some problems across the entire system. The Prime Minister and I, shortly after being elected, in fact I think a week after being elected, commissioned an audit of the rural and regional health workforce. This was a very determined step towards gaining a comprehensive understanding of the availability and shortages in the health workforce in rural and regional Australia. Everyone, of course, knows about these shortages, but so far pretty little has been done to properly address them. To take the most stunning example, and this is clear in the report that's being released today, many of the rural programs supported by my department, including incentives that are provided to doctors who work in rural and remote areas, are based on something known to some of you called RAMA, called the Rural, Remote and Metropolitan Areas Remoteness Classification. Now, the reason I want to tell you about this is even those of us who are living in Melbourne, which has been changing very fast in the last 10 and 15 years, is there anyone here from Brisbane or from Perth? We're going too far ahead. I'm sure some of you have travelled there, or for that matter to Geelong or to Ballarat. You will know that in the last 20 years our metropolitan landscape has changed dramatically. Yet the data that we base these incentive payments on is based on population figures that came from the 1991 census, data that is now nearly 17 years old. I cannot believe how ridiculous it is that we base so many of our funding tools that are meant to be designed on servicing population and need on this antiquated data and an antiquated system. It was a very blunt instrument and a sharp reminder, I think, of the last government's failure to undertake the hard work that's necessary for us to be able to reform our health system. The audit's given us the confirmation that we expected of the need to act in this area, and we are going to reform the classification system. I'm announcing today that we're immediately establishing in my department an Office of Rural Health, something that we currently don't have, to help drive the reform in rural health. I have over 60 different programs that are all run by my department with the single same aim of improving rural health services. None of them are run within the same divisions. None of them have the same classification structure. All of them mostly are based on this very old data. And really, I think it shows that there is no way we can actually support evidence-based interventions in this area and using the government's capacity to provide incentives where needed if we don't even have basic data. The audit confirmed anecdotal accounts that regional and remote Australians continue to be disadvantaged in their access to health professionals compared to urban counterparts. And there are a whole range of tables that take us through the range of difference, which I'm sure many of you in the sector will be pleased to have a look at. The audit's key findings, though, have highlighted the paucity of data, the multiplicity of programs, and their reliance on outdated methodologies. It has made clear that there continues to be a shortage of the health workforce and a shortage that is pushed, obviously, to the extremes in regional and rural communities. The growth in the numbers of medical practitioners hasn't kept pace with the growth in population over the same period, and what workforce there is unevenly distributed. Like doctors, dental workers are mainly located in metropolitan areas, and the distribution of allied health professionals and Aboriginal health workers is virtually unknown. The one thing that the report does show, perhaps surprisingly, is that nurses are the best distributed of our professions across the country. There is, of course, a national shortage. However, they are distributed fairly evenly. The audit highlights the lack of investment in comprehensive national health workforce data that we believe should have been a very necessary and important tool in planning for the health workforce needs of the country. As I've said, we run in excess of 60 different programs, all with the same aim of improving rural health services. These programs have been added to, they're ad hoc, they've plugged gaps as they've emerged, and individually many of these programs may well have improved health services. As a whole, however, they've left us with a complex web of services and incentives that are poorly coordinated, poorly understood by the very same communities they are supposed to assist, let alone the professions who might be interested in moving to take them up. So in short, the audit highlights just how much work remains to be done to deliver a health system that rural families deserve. And much of that work is going to be long term. That said, we know that there are pressing needs as well. Next month's budget is going to deliver some immediate relief by delivering on a range of rural health initiatives. We're going to double the number of John Flynn scholarships that are currently available to undergraduate medical students to undertake placements in rural and remote areas. We are establishing for the first time scholarships for clinical placements for allied health professionals in rural and remote communities, in recognition of the fact that it's not just doctors we're short of in rural areas, but a range of allied health professionals as well. We're investing nearly $8 million in supporting the specialist obstetrician locum scheme, which has been very successful in providing relief to those doctors who are remaining in rural areas to provide obstetric support, but often can't get someone to cover for them when they even want to have a holiday or retrain. Excuse me. And we're providing an extra $12 million to expand and enhance the medical specialist outreach program. We're also going to, and I'm announcing this today, provide an additional $6 million to fund a number of existing rural clinical schools, which have been very successful components of many education providers and some university departments of rural health, so that they can expand their capacity to provide rural education and training support. These include initiatives in Taree, the north coast of New South Wales, in Port Augusta in South Australia, in Cloncurry in Queensland, and Mount Isa and Longreach also in Queensland. Our new Office of Rural Health will, over the next 12 months, in close consultation with stakeholders, closely examine the 60-odd workforce programs that exist to ensure that they are streamlined, that they're not working at cross-purposes, and that they are properly targeted so that the most needy communities are supported the most. And, of course, we'll make sure that they're based on much more up-to-date data. Now, I know that none of these changes of themselves provide a complete answer, but they are down payments and important steps along the way. And as we're discovering in many other areas, really rural health is just an example for this audience today, we're now uncovering the true scale of neglect and the absence of strategy exhibited by the previous government, and really understand the time that it's going to take to fix this. And if these changes that are needed are going to deliver better healthcare to working families, we know we have to embark on them both now and the long-term reforms now, so that we have in 10 and 15 and 20 years' time probably somebody other than me standing here saying some of the decisions that we made in the coming weeks and months are ones that have set us in good stead for the future. I want to, before finishing, just touch upon, I guess, what I'm calling the dual track in our health policy. Some of these issues are examples of what we can do immediately, of steps we've already taken, of initiatives that we know will help ease some pressures immediately. But we also are laying down the foundations for the future. We're absolutely determined as a government to take a long-term view because we know that truly fixing the health system cannot be done in any one term of government, and we don't want to limit ourselves to the sorts of changes we might support by thinking just in a three-year cycle. The National Hospitals and Health Reform Commission, the COAG reform process and the Preventative Healthcare Task Force are all vehicles that we have set up and are going to help us deliver on this long-term reform. And the findings of the rural health audit that I've released today will provide valuable information to aid all of those processes. So let me run you quickly through those. The National Health and Hospitals Reform Commission was established in February. It's being tasked by mid-next year to provide us with advice on both short and long-term reforms to the health system, including the ways to improve the provision of health services in rural Australia and addressing the need to provide a well-qualified and sustainable health workforce into the future. Of course, as has been mentioned already, cooperation between the Commonwealth and state and territory governments is critical to delivering health care reform, and we've really been working hard both through health ministers and a revitalised COAG process to achieve this. I think I've now met formally with health ministers more times than in the last four months, more often than the previous minister has in the last 3 years. So we know, and these meetings are not for the fun of it. These meetings are where we're trying to negotiate out some very difficult reforms, and I've been pleased how enthusiastic the state ministers are to also engage in this process. Of course, COAG is considering major reforms in terms of the financial responsibilities, the responsibilities for funding and service delivery between levels of government, not just in health but in education and many other areas as well. A first step towards that is reversing the national trend of the Commonwealth cutbacks to hospital funding. We've recently agreed at the last COAG meeting to commit an extra $1 billion to relieve immediate pressures on public hospitals in the coming year. Overall, this means an increase in Commonwealth funding for public hospitals in the coming year of over 10%, the biggest single increase that has the hospital system has seen for a decade. The new healthcare agreement that is to be signed by the end of this year will bring into will allow the states and Commonwealth to deal with the funding arrangements for health and hospitals in a range of areas that previously haven't been negotiated together. Instead of just being a hospital agreement, this is going to be an agreement which is also about primary care, preventative care and public health programs. A health compact will be agreed between the Commonwealth, the states and the territories so that we establish a shared vision of outcomes and objectives that will deliver to the community and to patients and will improve the health system and enable the performance of all jurisdictions to be measured and reported to the community. Also in this long-term space, we know that investments in health promotion and disease prevention are going to deliver improvements in workforce participation and national productivity, as I flagged at the start of my speech. The Productivity Commission argues that about 100,000 deaths could be avoided by 2030 if we improved health promotion and disease prevention. And we know that every year 500,000 preventable admissions occur in our hospitals. So we need to shift this focus on prevention away from the margins of our health policy and our health policy debate, reinvigorate the role of frontline primary care, particularly in providing healthcare into local communities. And if we do these things, we will not only reduce our economic loss, we can actually turn it into an economic gain. And at the same time, we'll certainly take a lot of pressure off our hospitals. To help us do this, we've established a National Preventative Healthcare Task Force. This is being led by world expert Professor Rob Moody, probably known to many of you Victorians. And you've already seen that whilst we want that task force to be looking at a comprehensive plan for the future, and we've given them a particular focus on alcohol, tobacco and obesity as its first job, you've seen us taking action in the interim. We've acted quickly to tackle binge drinking, including closing an excise loophole that had led to huge increases in young women consuming these alcopops, and we've taken important steps to start addressing the unacceptable gaps in Indigenous health, including the high smoking rates that continue in our Indigenous communities. And, of course, there's much more still to come. So you can see that we have a lot of work in a lot of different areas that's progressing at once, But in all of our health policy approaches, the patient remains central to what we're trying to do. We want to focus on how we deliver better outcomes for people without allowing ourselves to become too distracted by a web of existing bureaucracies and professional turf wars that often impede them. Let me give you, before I finish, just one example of how we can get things the wrong way round. And it's an example that was told to me by a doctor who attended the 2020 conference the weekend before last. She works at a children's hospital, I think in the oncology area, in an area where children need to visit weekly, weekly or monthly, I'm not entirely sure, to get injections which are very painful that need to be delivered through their bones. When she started, the staff were very dejected and she said had lower morale than anywhere she had ever worked. And when she asked why this was, they all hastily assured her that it was millions of times better for the staff since the rooms had been soundproofed. She was absolutely shocked, as all of us would be, that the pain and distress that the kids were feeling had been fixed, at least partly, by making sure that the staff couldn't hear the screams of the children rather than trying to change the models of care. This has led to a passion for her to make our health system much more patient-centred and has included in their hospital innovations in using anaesthetics that previously were not used and providing families with pagers so they could wait in the park until the doctor was ready for them rather than wait while every other child had their treatment before them. Productivity, interestingly, has increased by 400%. So I think this is an example and a reminder that we need to focus on people. And we must remember when we do this that rural people deserve healthcare every bit as good as other people in the rest of the country. At the same time, we all must, as governments, professionals, businesses and the community, remember that health is also an economic proposition, that without adequate investment in healthcare, our economy is going to suffer and our workforce, will shrink. In determining how and where to act, we must base our actions on existing evidence. In some cases, that is going to involve us gathering additional data, something that we have flagged as crucial both in hospitals and in rural health. This does mean that some of our reforms will take time, but as a new government, I have to tell you, we're not prepared to embark upon avenues that may turn out to be dead ends simply because we didn't bother to get hold of an accurate map beforehand. So there's certainly a lot to be done in health. I've only touched upon some of it today in the time that we've got. We have a lot of work ahead of us, and we know it's not going to be easy or quick, but we do know that with attention, dedication, and a willingness to drive the change that is necessary, that we can deliver real and lasting improvements to health in this country, no matter where you happen to live. And the Rudd Labor government is committed to doing precisely that. Thank you.